Why diets don't work. The big lie of diet culture is that it makes us think that losing weight and staying slim is simply the result of willpower and control. I asked Laura Thomas, nutritionist and author of Just Eat It, to explain why it's not that simple. Popular narratives about weight suggest that if we burn more calories than we eat, we can successfully lose weight. This is known as the calories in versus calories out model. There are lots of permutations of this model, but they all work by creating a calorie deficit. However, these simple equations belie the complex physiological and psychological processes that take place in our bodies when we restrict our calorie intake below our body's needs, meaning that, in the long term, most people are likely to regain lost weight. The idea that diets don't work is not controversial among nutrition scientists. We have long known that people can lose weight successfully in the short term, but that maintaining the loss is often difficult. Estimates on the failure rate of diets vary from study to study, which is why it can sometimes be helpful to pull a few different studies together into one larger study called a meta-analysis. One such study analyzed 29 randomized controlled trials of long-term weight loss and found that more than 50% of weight lost was regained after 2 years. After 5 years, that number was up to 80%. A more recent meta-analysis looked specifically at commercial weight loss programs like Slimming World and Weight Watchers, and found that on these types of programs, almost 60% of people failed to lose 5% of their body weight in the first place. These findings suggest that 1, it can be difficult for people to lose weight initially, and 2, most weight loss is likely to be regained in the long term. We are told that diets fail because of a lack of willpower. However, weight regain is not a function of our resolve. It happens because of biological processes taking place in the body. Let's first look at the physiological changes that occur when we diet or try to lose weight. Our body does all it can to defend what is known as our set point weight, our biological blueprint for the weight that is optimal for our bodies in terms of our hormones, energy levels, and immune function. Instead of being a specific weight, it is more accurately thought of as a range that our body will fluctuate between. For instance, it may go down if we're sick and can't eat, or up slightly if we have an injury and can't move around as much. When we try to push our weight down below this optimal range, our body will make adaptations to try and keep it within those limits. It is thought that as much as 75% of our weight is down to our genetics. Contrast that with height, which is 80% of our genetics. But we never hear of the get taller diet. That would be ludicrous. So, how does our body defend our set point weight when we go on a diet? Firstly, it does this by making changes to our appetite. People who are restricting their intake may have higher circulating levels of the hunger hormone, ghrelin. This is an evolutionary mechanism to get us up off our butts when food is scarce. In practical terms, this may mean that our cravings intensify, and we might feel preoccupied with thoughts of food and end up spending half the day Googling recipes that fit our meal plans. On the flip side of this equation, we may also become less sensitive to our fullness cues. This is because of lower circulating levels of fullness hormones like leptin. This means we'll feel less satisfied after our meals and like we're never totally full. On top of changes to our hunger and satiety cues, there are changes to our metabolic rate. It slows slightly to help conserve energy. Our bodies can't tell that we're in a voluntary food deficit. It just assumes that food is scarce. Just a trigger warning for the next 15 seconds that I'm going to be mentioning a number, so feel free to skip forward 15 seconds from now. For each kilogram of weight lost, our metabolism slows by about 20 to 30 kcal per day, and our appetite increases by about 100 kcal per day. Not only do weight loss attempts tend to result in weight regain over time, but they may also be associated with higher risks of eating disorders and disordered eating. In a large study of 14 to 15-year-old adolescents who were followed up for 3 years, those who dieted moderately had a 5-fold increased risk of developing an eating disorder. The adolescents who severely restricted their energy intake and skipped meals were 18 times more likely to develop an eating disorder than those who did not diet. It's thought that dieting may also be related to binge eating, loss of muscle mass and strength, low mood due to less serotonin production, anxiety, depressive symptoms, and poor body image. What's more, dieting is, in and of itself, a predictor of future weight gain. Although the evidence for this is less clear, it does seem that weight cycling, or yo-yo dieting, might be harmful for our health. Repeatedly losing and gaining weight might be related to more heart problems, worse blood sugar, and poorer mental health compared to those whose weight doesn't fluctuate. The relationship between weight and health is a lot less stressful, lot less straightforward than thin equals healthy and fat equals unhealthy. BMI is a crude measure of an individual's health, but it can be helpful in giving us some information about populations. Many people believe that there is a linear relationship between BMI and poor health. In other words, the higher the BMI, the worse health will be. However, there is actually a J-shaped curve between BMI and health outcomes. Let me explain. A recent study of over 3.6 million GP records from the UK found that those with a BMI of around 25, considered overweight, had the lowest risk of death, and those who have a BMI of 30 had a slightly lower risk compared to those who had a BMI of 18. This tells us that weight, in and of itself, is not a great predictor of health. It doesn't provide us the whole story. A more helpful measure of health risk might be to look at what's known as cardiorespiratory fitness, basically a measure of fitness level. Large meta-analysis studies have found that the risk of death from all causes, i.e. communicable and non-communicable disease, is almost identical regardless of BMI when fitness levels are high. Yep, people in the lowest BMI group, normal, had the same level of risk as those in higher BMI groups. When fitness levels were low, however, the risk was double that of the fit group. But again, this was seen across all weight groups. The drawing here is that in this study, fitness was a more important predictor of health than fatness. In another study of more than 12,000 Americans, researchers asked questions about four lifestyle variables thought to be important for overall health: not smoking, moderate alcohol intake, moderate exercise, and nutrition. They found that when people didn't engage in any of the four behaviors, the risk of poor health outcomes was, unsurprisingly, highest, and the higher their BMI, the worse the outcome. However, when people in the highest BMI category engaged in just one of the health-promoting behaviors, the risk of death was cut in half. If people in the highest BMI category engaged in all four behaviors, then the risk was exactly the same as people in the lowest weight category. Again, this seems to indicate that health behaviors are more important for overall health than looking at someone's weight. And although these studies are just observational, it also aligns with evidence from randomized control trials which suggest these behaviors are helpful, no matter your weight. It's important to note though, as much as 15% of our health status may be determined by our family history and genetic predisposition, which we have no control over. But by far, the biggest contribution to our health outcomes is our socioeconomic status, accounting for around 50%. Health falls along a socioeconomic gradient, meaning the poorest and most deprived in society are the most likely to have poor health-related outcomes. Public Health England estimates that people in the least deprived parts of England live, on average, 19 more years in good health than people in the most deprived areas. And even if people living in deprived areas engage in health-promoting behaviours, it's unlikely to be enough to make up for that disadvantage. The Food Foundation's Broken Plate report put this into context. If everyone were to follow Public Health England's Eat Well Guide, people in the lowest 10% of household income would end up spending 75% of their disposable income on food, and people in the most affluent 10% of the country would only spend 6%. While no one is disputing that nutrition can have an impact on health, we often forget to zoom out and put into perspective the wider determinants of health. That was an excerpt that I was reading from Tally Rye's Train Happy book. And specifically that excerpt sort of has come from Laura Thomas. She's a nutritionist and author of Just Eat It. So there you go. As promised, I said I would make a video on why diets don't work.